Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacevic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. Hello, it is my pleasure today to welcome Paul Crocker. Welcome, Paul.
Hello.
Now, today I want to change the format a little bit. I didn't bring in one of the industry thought leaders, but instead I want to bring in a practitioner, you know, a gentleman who is truly working every day in the maintenance department, working hard to implement those best practices that we talk about every week. You know, this gentleman, Paul, you've made significant headway in your journey to best-in-class reliability and maintenance programs. It is my hope today that you'll be able to provide some great insights to what it has taken to make that headway and those improvements in a maintenance reliability program. So welcome, Paul.
All right, thank you. I'll do my best to answer that.
Perfect. So, Paul, you've been with the Kansas City Board of Public Utilities for 23 years, and it's your ninth year as a maintenance supervisor at the Nearman Water Treatment Plant.
Uh-huh.
You hold a Bachelor's of Science in Network and Communications Management, a Class 4 drinking water operator, a Class 3 maintenance technologist, you're a CRL, you're an ultrasound technology leader, and you're currently working on getting your reliability engineering certificate from Life Cycle Engineering and Kansas University.
Correct.
You also happen to recently be part of the founding of the Kansas City chapter of SMRP. So congratulations. That is a difficult thing to achieve. I'm working on trying to restart the Detroit chapter, and it hasn't been easy so far. So,
yeah, thank you. It's been a long progress thing getting going.
So I covered that introduction. Did I miss any key pieces there?
I don't think so. I'm kind of starting to study for and pass the CMRP. That's the next certification I want to get. So that one's a big deal to me. So I want to be really prepared before going to that test.
Excellent. It is a difficult one. A lot of it's based on experience. But with what you have here, Paul, I think you'll be very successful.
All right.
So how long have you been involved in maintenance and reliability?
Well, I kind of been maintaining and playing with things kind of my whole life, but as a paid position, I guess it's kind of a two-part answer. Back in the late 90s, I had a computer repair business I ran for 2 or 3 years. But at my daytime job at BPU, I've kind of been doing some light operator maintenance stuff. But then when I got my current position, so I'd say probably 9 years in a dedicated maintenance position.
Excellent, excellent. Now, I'm sure you've learned lots over those last 9 years. And as a testament to that, you recently, at the IMC this year in 2016, won an Uptime Award. Is that correct?
Yep, it is.
So can you tell me a little bit about that Uptime Award?
Yeah, the award I won is for, I got it right here in front of me. Let me read it because I don't want to misstate what it says on it in front of it. Says Uptime Awards, it's a great honor to present this distinction 2016 Special Recognition Award, Innovative Use of Photography for Maintenance, Kansas City Board of Public Utilities, UptimeMagazine.com. So in my role, I've been taking pictures of things kind of since day one. And I've got, I think, probably a collection of pictures on the server at work, probably 30-some thousand now. I just take pictures of stuff all the time, and I was like, you know what? I really need to get my guys used to taking pictures. So I went through building some training material, and at IMC last year, I saw my friends George Williams and Rob Bishop and many other people win Uptime Awards for work they've done at their companies. And I was like, you know, I don't have kind of the developed maintenance and reliability programs, you know, specific things like they have, but I do have one that I haven't seen anybody talk about, and that's photography. So I submitted an abstract or whatever to get an Uptime Award for that. And then, probably several other documents and a couple interviews and things kind of made it through all those different levels of it and kind of progressed to get the Uptime Award for it this year.
And I recently watched that presentation you did on photography for maintenance. And you know what? It provided some great insights. People don't commonly think of photography being related to maintenance reliability, but the way you presented it, it showed how useful it can be, whether it's capturing equipment data, whether it's looking at an issue or defect you need to correct. And one of the big pieces that I really took away from that presentation was how you trained your guys. No one thinks of it. It's photography. You take a camera, you look at it. But the way you approached it, here, go take a picture, see what results they got, and then let's start teaching them how to use the basics of that camera. I think that was a very, very good and practical approach to training. And, you know, I learned a couple things from that that I'm going to take away in the training I provide to people.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. I think I just barely kind of scratched the surface of what there is. And there's a lot, so much you can go into depth with it. But I think what's changed is in the last 10 years, we've got this digital technology. CMOS sensors are really cheap. You know, most people have two of them on their phones now. And they're very high quality. You know, they're not dedicated photography devices, you know, like a standalone SLR camera or something. But they do good enough, and you can use them for a lot of things. I think people have kind of, there was that transition from film to digital, and people have just kind of just been using it to take pictures, you know, for like Facebook and Instagram, and they kind of don't think, well, hey, I could use this at work to record stuff that's important, like getting serial numbers. I mean, I have some guys that were kind of reluctant to use their own personal phones for taking pictures, and I'd say, hey, I need to go have you go get the serial number off of this device, and they'd bring it back to me, and it's like, I couldn't read their handwriting, so I'd go with them and take the camera and take the picture of myself. But I was like, you know what? I got better things to do than take pictures myself. I need to get the guys taught how to do this. So that's kind of how it all got started.
Yeah. And did you start that photography when you took over the maintenance at the Nearman Water Plant?
Yeah, they had a little, I think it was like a Panasonic camera, or something like a 1 or 2 megapixel. And shortly after I got it, it quit working. And my boss says, hey, you know, I know you like putting pictures in your monthly reports and stuff to us. You know, we got some money at the end of the year and go out and pick out a camera at the local store. So that's what I did. And I've kind of been through 4 or 5 of them now as I kind of wear them out. But Canon, Sony, they're all pretty good cameras.
Now, the one question I have, you mentioned you have some 30,000 pictures. How do you organize all those images? Do you classify them by asset number, by equipment type? Class, how do you do it?
That is a continual struggle, and most people I know that take a lot of pictures, it's a struggle for them too. There's not like any one best practice for it. So how I've done it at work, and our CMMS is structured this way, is by location area. So we have like a high service, we have a compressed gas room, bulk storage, chemical feed areas, and basin, and horizontal collector well. So I kind of, as I take pictures of those areas, equipment in those areas, I create a folder. I usually put it in one of those, a lot of date, usually with the year first in it. That way, if you sort it, it'll sort by year instead of month, which is handy if you're looking for a specific year. Then you put the month and date. It'll kind of help you drill through the pictures to look for what you're wanting. And then the second piece is into the CMMS for stuff that's like part of a work order or whatever that's important to a specific thing we're working on. I'll attach the files to the work order in the CMMS. So they kind of end up to two different places.
Yeah, because I know that's something I've always struggled with. Sometimes I'll try, you know, the equipment number, then maybe the date, and then the issue we were taking a picture of or something like that, and it never seems to work, so.
Yeah, I wish somebody would come up with, hey, this is the best practice, and, you know, somebody needs to create an ISO standard for how to save pictures.
Revision 2 of ISO 55,000.
Yeah. Photography.
So, you took over the Nearman Water Plant about 9 years ago. You implemented this photography for maintenance. How did you first feel when you took over that leadership role at the Nearman Water Plant?
Honestly, probably intimidated, overwhelmed, inadequate. I knew all the guys that were working for me because I'd worked for them at the power plants. And as an operator at the water plant, I was an operator there for a year because I kind of have a calling for water anyway. And so it's a big deal to be able to provide clean drinking water, not just to keep people healthy, but for everything else you use water for. And my bosses knew that I had a background, you know, in IT, and they had the CMMS that they had that was purchased when the plant was built, but it really had never been used. So that was one of the reasons it got me in the role, but I really hadn't, I don't think I was totally prepared for the maintenance supervisor position. Like say you end up transitioning from one role as an operator into a maintenance supervisor. And I think all the staff that I have now was prepared for that, but I don't think I was prepared for it as they were. So a culture shock kind of more than anything else.
Yeah, I can relate to that. When I took my first maintenance supervisor position, I was actually day before working with the guys as an industrial electrician at the facility. Next day, I'm their supervisor. It was
definitely a huge shock and change of pace and responsibilities. And it was something that, you know, was very, very intimidating.
Yeah, my boss, he moved up to the superintendent of maintenance and operations. So he kind of directs the day-to-day operations with the operators, and then he's also my boss. And so, but there was like, it was just a one-day transition. It's like, hey, Paul, here's the keys to the office. It's like, there's, you know, there's no, hey, you do this first in the morning, then you go and talk to the guys. It was kind of like sink or swim, so.
Yeah. Hey, sometimes that's the best way to learn.
Yeah, it is. I seem to do that most often in my life.
Learn the hard way.
Yep.
Excellent. So what was one of the largest challenges when you first took that role? Obviously, culture shock being one of them, but walking into that maintenance supervisor role.
Well, before that, I'd say most of the jobs I'd ever had, even outside of the utility, I think I've worked since I was 16. I think my first paying job, I was 16, and I'm 47 now. But it was really the first job I've ever had where there's a constant juggling of responsibilities. So, you know, I've got the people that report to me, and I've got my bosses, and, you know, I've also got other duties like ordering parts and meeting vendors and meeting contractors, kind of day-to-day managing the CMMS, and just lots of other things around the plant. It seems like I only have 5 to 10 minutes to do any one given task versus the guys that work for me. I'll give them a job to go do, and so they're kind of doing all the stuff, and they don't have any interruptions. So there's this constant stream of interruptions for things always trying to get my attention. And that is kind of even a struggle to this day, is just juggling all that constant distraction.
And that's part of maintenance, is juggling those short-term needs and the long-term goals and reliability that we want to drive to the site. It's a never-ending challenge.
Definitely true.
So once you took that role and you got a little bit settled, you obviously realized that not everything was where it should be in terms of maintenance, reliability, or asset management best practices. So how did you go about bringing change to the site and to the maintenance program in general?
That's a couple things. One of the first duties I had, and it was before I was maintenance supervisor, they had a storeroom at the plant, and it was a room that's upstairs. It's kind of it's a little bit away from the maintenance area, but it's secured. There's a locked door on it, and people would go in there and put whatever parts when the plant was new. We transitioned from a plant that was about 100 years old and moved equipment from that plant that could be used at the new plant, and kind of as they bought new things, they'd store them in this room, but there was no structure to it. I mean, there was chemical metering pump parts kind of all over the place. There was motor parts kind of all over the place. The first maintenance supervisor there was who had a background in nuclear submarines as a kind of a maintenance guy. And so he kind of knew what everything was in the room. I had spent time in my career working in parts and in storerooms, so I kind of knew how storerooms and parts got organized. And so we kind of worked together to grab everything and put it where it was and kind of put it by functional location order. So we had all our chlorine handling stuff and ammonia handling stuff in one area, and our metering pump parts in another area, electrical control parts in another area, you know, as kind of... So that was like the first thing. We spent 2 weeks doing that. And one of the things, we were going to just write this stuff down on paper. And it's like, you know what? We got a computer. We got Excel. Let's just put all this stuff in Excel. So that was kind of the first kind of organizational thing. It kind of just took a storeroom that was more or less in chaos, and you had to rely on the guy that put the part in there to know where it was at, to organizing it, putting on Excel, and then getting it uploaded into Maximo. It kind of at the same time this was happening, we had an implementer on site that was getting us upgraded from, I think, a version 4 of Maximo to 5.2. And so when she was on site, we was able to get this Excel file to her of all this stuff, and she uploaded it all into Maximo and built the storeroom for us. So we had really good inventory count and part descriptions and all that right from the get-go. And then the next piece was really transitioning the guys to start to use Maximo. There was a lot of apprehension because none of these guys had ever come from really a field where they had to use work orders for that sort of thing. So there's a lot of culture shock and stuff around that, and trying to get buy-in from the different guys. Some the younger guys were a little bit more open to it. The older guys, not so much.
That's one of the hardest things to make that change, is that culture change. So how did you go about doing that? And what was the hardest part behind making that culture shift in your maintenance department?
It's still a bit of a struggle. I think really the key thing is just to do it slowly. You know, I think there's a tendency when you want to make any kind of change is to just change it real fast. You know how you want it to work in your head. But, you know, if you're thinking about systems or processes, that's sort of easy. You tell the computer what you want it to do and it does it, or you tell the machine what you want it to do and it does it, but people don't work that way. So you got to kind of get their buy-in and get them to see, hey, this is about, you know, using some hardware to remember things that we forget, you know, like what we worked on, what parts we used on, you know, what condition did we find a piece of equipment or whatever we were working on in, and to get them to put all that, you know, into the system. So I'd say I tried to take my time and to get them used to work orders printed, not even touching the CMMS. We'd create the work order, I'd print it out, I'd hand it to them, they'd go do the work, they'd write the parts on it, they'd write down the details. And slowly over time, we kind of transitioned to using that on the computer. But culture change is a difficult thing, and I just kind of found that it's best if you take it slow, because there's no quick, easy wins. Not that I've experienced, anyway.
Yeah, it's probably the hardest part of making any changes. But, you know, you have your CRL, which focuses on the leadership piece, right? And I think that leadership is very, very important in making any sort of culture change.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's one thing I love about the CRL is the whole leadership and bird's eye view. You know, so you can look at the chart and say, hey, this is what the CMMS fits in this whole thing that we do. It's not just the CMMS is the asset management system, because it's not. Sometimes people look at me like, what do you mean it's not? It even says asset management system right in the title, but it's not really what it is. It's a work management tool, and it touches a lot of other things in across maintenance, that's for certain, but it's not the key. It's not the key piece that holds it all together, I guess.
No, it's a tool, and like every other tool, it's how you use it and how you leverage it will greatly affect the results you get from it.
Yep, true.
So you went through that. Obviously, it's a significant change going from maximal four to 5.2. What drove that?
I don't know. That kind of happened right before I got there. They had already chosen an implementer, and kind of when I bid into the water plant, they were already amidst that version 5.2 upgrade. So I kind of really had never touched Maximo prior to that, so really my first hands-on experience was building the storeroom piece. I think we had version 4 whatever for just like a few days, and then 5.2 was up and running. So I kind of got to use just kind of 5.2 as the initial system I ever touched.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out Iridicio's IBL Blended Learning for Maintenance and Reliability Professionals. This SMRP-accredited project-based curriculum will take you through all aspects of a maintenance and reliability program and provides you with all the tools you need to generate a 30 times return on investment for your organization and a set of credentials from the University of Tennessee for you. You can find out more at ibltraining.com.
You just came into it when it was being implemented, but I'm sure there were some things that, you know, was difficult in that transition, that implementation. What would you recommend to those who are looking to upgrade or implement the CMMS? What did you learn during that you could share with everyone else?
Well, I did take some IBM classes, some really good ones, and one of the instructors that we had in the class said, look, and she was absolutely right. She said, you need to take your time. You know, if you're looking at doing a CMMS implementation, you need to really sit down with all the stakeholders and really line out on paper all of your business processes and procedures. Because until you get all those things worked out, if you try and do it like on the fly as you're working with an implementer, it's just going to be chaos. And so I really think it's paramount that people understand they really need to have everything down on paper. They need to have a very clear understanding of how all their business processes work, and then especially the things that they want to have in the CMMS and how those things touch and interact with the CMMS. It's really important to know how all that works before you even start undertaking any software implementation.
Yeah, and the one thing I've seen done incorrectly quite often is people will take the CMMS process flow and they'll say, okay, now our business has to run like this because this is how the software is. And
right now.
That's a completely wrong approach.
It is. It's a very wrong approach. You need to make the CMMS mirror your business practices. You know, where there's room for improvement, there's always things, you know, you'll find out, well, why are we doing it that way? That's kind of crazy. You know, you can streamline your processes as you're kind of doing this discovery of what you want the CMMS to do and how you want it to do it. And then you make it do it. I mean, most of these are pretty configurable, so you can make it do just about anything you want and how you want. So, but yeah, it is absolutely key to have all that done up front on paper and worked out all those details before you ever have a business partner come in and help you do the implementation.
Absolutely. Now, Looking back, so you talked about mapping those business processes, managing those stakeholders, but what is the one thing you didn't consider when you're going through this, and as you made these improvements over the years to it, that you wish you knew beforehand?
Kind of maybe the classification systems within it. It would have been nice to have some of that built out, particularly in parts naming. Could have named things a lot more uniformly if we'd had a classification system in place, because you can kind of build the asset names or item master descriptions from classifications. It would have been just a quicker, more streamlined process, I think, if we'd have done it that way. But it's not a huge regret, but it's one of the things I'd like after the fact. I was like, man, I wish we'd have used that.
Yeah, so building the class type and then some attributes to generate your spare part field. So having that taxonomy, if you will.
Exactly, yep.
I'm currently working with an organization who's implementing a new CMMS, and that's what we're focused in on, is developing that data structure for their spare part, because they learned from their previous one that if you don't have that, you'll have five of the same bearings in one plant. They're just all named different.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, manufacturers don't typically like to use the same descriptions or part numbers, so it's kind of important to get all the key information right up front in your descriptions.
Absolutely. But it's not an easy task by all means. It takes a tremendous amount of time to develop that standard and then to actually go through and clean all the SKUs. It's a very long, time-consuming process.
Yeah, we didn't have a taxonomy standard to look at when we did this. It was kind of all after the fact. It's like, man, it would have been nice to know that. Or it would have been nice to know somebody that knew something about those taxonomy systems that we could have built on to do this. But I think we've done a pretty darn good job. I think most people come through and we show them the plant. It's like, to me, our part storeroom isn't all that great. You know, I've seen lots of start, but people always stop and marvel at that part storeroom. I don't know. Maybe I've not been in enough plants to see other people how they do their parts, but people always seem amazed when they go in there. We've got barcode labels on the parts. We've got the bin numbers on them, and all the parts are, you know, labeled and everything's organized. So.
And that surprised me, because I had the privilege of going through the Nearman Water plant with you.
Yep.
Going back, when was that? August?
Last August. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was walking into that storeroom, that's exactly it. You had labels for everything. It was barcoded. You knew what was where and what wasn't in stock and all that. It was visual. It was easy to follow and well organized. So I've been in quite a few storerooms now, and yours is by far probably one of the most organized, well laid out storerooms that I've seen so far.
Well, thank you.
So, you know, you've made all these changes in your organization. You've made significant headway, you know. Do you have any tips or words of wisdom you want to share with the people listening who are currently working to improve their maintenance reliability program?
I probably said earlier, maybe take your time. You know, it's a journey, and there's always this thing you want to do it right up front. You want to get in there and just get it done, but it's really not possible. You just kind of have to put one foot in front of the other and make culture changes as you can and improvements when you can and build off successes as much as you can, and then kind of engage people really from, you know, top general manager, board, down to the lowest paid worker, and even contractors and customers when it's appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. Engaging everyone, all those stakeholders, is absolutely critical. Now, if you were to go back 9 years ago, what is the one thing you would have done differently in your journey so far?
Learn more about leadership and culture change up front. Like I said, those were kind of the big two. And I think knowing a little bit more about leadership and culture, you know, I'm looking at maybe doing some master's level type work around leadership. So I'll finally kind of get that piece. But I've heard the saying, and you probably have too, that the soft stuff is the hard stuff. And in my experience, that's 100% true. You know, like I said earlier, you can make processes, equipment, do pretty much anything you want, whenever you want. That's not really much of a challenge, but people take time and they want to understand what their role is and how those changes are going to affect them and what's in it for me. We kind of all that way. I'm not any different than anybody else is in that respect.
Yeah, and it's a whole science in itself, that managing change, culture change. There's a great book that I have on my shelf next to my desk, and it's called ADKAR. And it's based on some of the PROSI framework. And
okay.
But what it stands for is Awareness, Desire, Knowledge, Ability, Reinforce. And it's a basic framework on how to implement culture and change in an organization. The book is actually quite small. It's maybe 100, 120 pages, but it's chock full of great one-pointers, excellent tips, and some framework on, if you're in this phase, how do you manage people accordingly to help them through that change? So, Paul, I'd recommend that book highly, because it definitely provides some quick, easy wins for you as a leader trying to learn how to manage that change.
Yeah, I've not heard of the book, so when you publish this, make sure you put that kind of in the text somewhere. Send me an email so that book so I can look it up when I get a chance.
Yeah, definitely will do. So, you know, you've provided a great amount of information to our listeners so far, but I'm going to ask you, what is the one action you want the listeners to take away from this episode in regards to improving their maintenance reliability program?
Take your time. It's not a race. It's not a competition. There's no prize for finishing first. You know, but be diligent. Put a stake in the ground. Declare maintenance and reliability. Begin with you. And don't let setbacks discourage you.
Excellent. That's fantastic words. You make that statement and you start moving forward. And like you said, it's not a race. We want to get to that end goal, but we want to do so sustainably. I constantly see organizations that will go from nothing to the latest and greatest predictive technology, but then 3 months later, nothing's working because they didn't put those foundations in place and grow it in a sustainable manner.
Yep.
So, Paul, you're a practitioner. You're working day in, day out. You're just at IMC. You won that award. Are you going to be at any other conferences or planning any other speaking events in the near future?
Maximo World will be a standalone conference on its own, I think, in Orlando this year. I want to say the first week in August. So I've already kind of been tossing around an idea of doing a presentation at that one. But certainly if I can get to them, the Reliability Conference in Vegas, IMC again in December. But this year we're going to have the National SMRP Conference in Kansas City. So I'm definitely going to be involved with that one.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. You know, I was at the one in Jacksonville. I already figured out what I'm going to put forth for my abstracts for the presentations in Kansas City, and I'll definitely see you there.
All right. Oh, definitely. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. It'll be a fantastic event, you know.
Yep.
And it'll be good to see you again, too.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
So, you know, before we close out, do you have any resources or favorite books that you want to share with our listeners for those lurking to learn more about maintenance reliability?
Yeah, I kind of wrote some down today. I'm kind of a water guy, and so there's a really great book out there. It's called The Chlorine Revolution, Water Disinfection and the Fight to Save Lives. And the author is Michael J. McGuire. He's been in a longtime water guy, but it's really a great book. I mean, people have no idea when they turn on the tap today and they get clean drinking water, the history of how that even got put in place. It's an amazing journey from where we were even less than 100 years ago to where we are today. It's just a fantastic read in of its own. But then reliabilityweb.com, pretty much everything on that website, every link from that website, the CRL information, uptime elements, and all the body of knowledge that goes with the uptime elements. Ramesh Kalati's foundational book, Maintenance Best Practices, Ron Moore's books, What to a Win, and Making Common Sense Common Practice. And then Reliability Centered Maintenance, RCM2 by John Mowbray. Those are kind of the books I'm looking at now.
Excellent. And you know what? They're all great books. I'm actually working through Making Common Sense Common Practice right now. And What to a Win is next on the list for me. So, you know what? It's great to hear that people out there are reading the exact same books I am. So,
yeah, I've got the first reliability conference I went to, I got Ramesh's book, and he was at the conference, so I had him sign it. And then at IMC, it was the first time I'd actually seen Ron Moore in person, so I bought the books while I was at IMC, and I had Ron sign those. So I'm trying to get all these authors. I've got three books from Joel Lovett I'm going to be sending to him to get his John Hancock on. So.
You know what? It's funny. I got my copy of Maintenance Reliability Best Practices by Ramesh signed by him. I actually had him come in and speak to our organization a couple of years ago, and it was very good. You know, he went through what is reliability, his three pillars of how to make reliable equipment and all that. He did a very good job.
Yeah, I got to sit with him at dinner one night at IMC and just kind of pick his brains a little bit. And I was kind of asking, you know, how long did take you to write the book? And he was telling me it's like 7 years. And so it's like I got a lot of perspective. You look at the guys, they're leaders and thought leaders in the whole maintenance and reliability community, and you think, well, man, they had it going on and they got everything right up front. Well, that's not always the case. They work through the same struggles that we have, and they've written great books on it. But it was good. It was good to sit and just chat with him a little bit.
Yeah.
And, but I guess I can't leave out one of my best friends in this whole maintenance reliability journey is Terrence O'Hanlon of Reliability Web. And I'm kind of always telling him, kind of in my theme of my emails is, that what you do matters. You know, you provide a great space for people in the maintenance reliability community to get together and talk and discuss all the things that go along with that. And it's really true. And I think that's one thing that's true about the community as a whole is just about anybody. And I've not come across any yet that haven't are very helpful. If there's something you're struggling with, there's somebody out there that knows answers or has insight or is willing to help whatever it takes to help you improve what it is you're doing. So we're a part of a great community, and that's across the board, horizontals, verticals, you name it. People are in this maintenance, reliability, and asset management realm.
Absolutely. You know, Terrence O'Hanlon, he came on, talked to us about the future of asset management. I'm trying to get him on for another one in the future. But anyone in this, like you said, in this community is willing to help each other out and help you overcome those challenges. So for those out there that are listening, if you're struggling with something, don't hesitate to reach out and ask. If you think it's a silly question, it doesn't matter. Send that email, ask that person, if you see him in person, for their insights. You know, it makes a huge difference. They're more than willing to help, and you'll grab some insights that will cut months and years off your learning curve.
Oh yeah, and LinkedIn's got some great communities. The AMP forum on LinkedIn, or just LinkedIn in general, has got some awesome. You can post a picture or whatever it is you're looking at that you're having a problem with. And the last one I did, there was like 60 or 70 people that wrote replies, you know, saying, "Hey, look at this, do this, check this out. I think it's this," and it was helpful. I mean, some of them were spot on. A few were kind of some other things I hadn't thought of before, but it's all good stuff. There was nobody said, you know, nobody had any negative remarks. Why would you post that? Or you should have already known that answer.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all willing to help. So, well, Paul, I want to thank you for taking the time today to share your journey in maintenance reliability with everyone. I know I took away some other great tips once again, and I'm sure our listeners have learned something that they can apply in their organization that they're trying to overcome. So, thank you for taking the time. It's greatly appreciated.
Yeah, thank you, James. I appreciate the interview.
All right. Well, thank you, and you have yourself a great night.
All right, you too.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the Reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.